What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Katie Helper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Helper. If you like the show, please leave us a five-star review on iTunes, and as always, remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow, where for just $1 a month, you can help make the show happen. And for $5 a month, you'll qualify for great bonus content, including alternative podcast feed and rarely seen clips that aired on our live shows. Hello and welcome to The Katie Helper Show. On today's show, I'm playing two interviews. First, I speak to Palestinian-American journalist Rami Khoury about the Middle East. Then I talk to Arturo De Simone, an Aruban Argentine writer who challenges the claim that October 7th was the biggest massacre against Jews since the Holocaust. As always, please like the stream. Please subscribe by hitting subscribe and then hitting the bell. And please help make this show possible by becoming Patreon supporters at patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow, where you can find extended interviews, including the full interview I do with Rami Khoury. And here is the public portion of my interview with Rami. Thank you so much, Rami Khoury, for joining us. Rami Khoury is a Distinguished Public Policy Fellow at the American University of Beirut and a non-resident senior fellow at Arab Center Washington, D.C. He's also a journalist, a prolific journalist, and the author of several books, including most recently, Understanding Hamas and Why That Matters, which he co-wrote with Helena Coban of Just World Books. So thank you so much for joining.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I just wanted to talk about what you think is most notable in terms of what has changed in the world because of October 7th, and also what you think the biggest misunderstandings of October 7th are right now.
Well, there's a lot of things there, but if I were to choose a few that were the most significant, I think the most significant thing is that the October 7 attack, with the Israeli response, but even before the Israeli response, I think the intention of the attack succeeded in totally upending the status quo in the Middle East and threw everything up in the air without any clarity about what was going to happen. As one prominent scholar of Hamas who has studied them and knows them and has written books on them said that they rolled the dice without knowing exactly what was going to be the repercussions, but knowing that they would pay a heavy price. So that's the first thing, is that the whole regional status quo has been upended and is up in the air, and we don't know where it's going to land. I think the second thing is that the Israeli response has not only shattered Gaza and shattered hundreds of pagers and walkie-talkies in Lebanon, it's also shattered the foundation of international law and human rights protections that the Western world set up by the action of the winners of World War II. After World War II, the world set up the system of international law and protection of human rights and to prevent the kind of atrocities that happened in World War II, and especially the Nazi genocide against the Jews. Well, the state that says it represents the Jews of the world has completely shattered that order and shown that there is no such thing as an international community, which is what people talk about, the international community. There is no international community, and there is no international law. to speak of. Maybe there's international law that determines the size of a container that can be shipped, but there's no international law that is respected and implemented by the powers that created these laws and conventions and treaties and UN resolutions. This stuff is all just paper now. And if the international community could not intervene to stop the genocide, or what the International Court of Justice said was a genocide, a plausible genocide in Gaza, then international law is a imaginary thing. That's the second thing, I think, that happened. And then the third thing, I think, is that the Arab order, the order of states, sovereign states that emerged after World War I across the Arab world, about the same time as the Zionist movement was started to work with British colonial powers to create a Jewish state that became Israel, that whole state order of Arabs or of Arab peoples has proven to be a docile non-actor in the region. It's very disappointing. But they've been sitting around watching this stuff on Jazeera, and whether it's Gaza or Lebanon or the Iran-Israel exchanges, and we don't know what's coming next. But the Arab world is totally not there. They don't exist. And the only people doing the fighting against Israel are non-state Arab armed groups, Hezbollah, Hamas, Ansarullah, and a couple of others, and Iran. So we're dealing with a situation in which state sovereignty in the Arab world has shown itself to be slightly fictitious or notional. It's not really solid. And the people, the groups that do fight, I'm not saying that we should fight all the time, but when there is a conflict, people are fighting each other. The only people doing the fighting in the Arab world are these non-state actors. And they emerged often, especially Hamas and Hezbollah, they came to life as a response to Israeli occupation and subjugation and humiliation and colonial settlements and things like that. So the whole region has revealed its weaknesses and its fictions. And the overriding, the last point I'd make is that the overriding theme of what I see happening, and it became most clear recently with Iran and Israel getting into the battle with each other, and the U.S. on the side of Israel fighting directly against Iran, even if in a defensive mode. The last thing that became clear was that the colonial era never ended. The U.S. and Great Britain, the two great colonial powers, the tag team powers of the last century, the British first and then the Americans after World War II, those two great Western colonial powers have been the enthusiastic armorers, financiers, diplomatic protection, and cheerleaders for the Israeli plausible genocide in Gaza. It's astounding how that is. And also with the Iran entry into the fighting directly, we see that the British and the Americans, we see that the British and the Americans are the two Western colonial powers that historically and today are the most active in tormenting Middle Eastern states and peoples. And I give you two specific dates and incidents that shape that, in my view. One is the 1917 Balfour Declaration, which the British, Great Britain, did to promise a home for the Jews in Palestine, which was 93% Arab then. And Britain didn't even have control of it when it made that promise. But that's how colonialism works. So that 1917 colonial crime by Great Britain in collusion with the Zionist movement was a historic turning point for the modern Middle East. The second one, the second date and event, is the 1953 Anglo-American overthrow of the elected Mossadegh government in Iran. And it's not an accident of history that you have now the Iranian government and the Hezbollah and Hamas are the key fighters now, pushing back against British and American colonial traditions and active colonial adventures in Gaza and other places. It's no accident, because these two are the kind of bookends of the century of colonial torment of Middle Eastern people, and it's still going on with the British and the Americans leading it, which is pretty fascinating. So we need the historians and the political psychiatrists to come in here and give us some analysis.
Yeah, that's very important. The historical analysis, I think, is often left out. I mean, we see a lot of the discourse that the media and politicians engage in the West overtly actually say that this all started on October 7th. That there was a ceasefire on October 6th that was broken on October 7th. What's your response to that framing of where we are right now?
Well, this is typical Israeli propaganda, which tries to justify what they then subsequently did, which was a plausible genocide in the eyes of the highest international court. The idea that there was a ceasefire is not... I mean, there may have been a ceasefire signed a few years ago to stop an immediate exchange of fire missiles and stuff between Hamas and Israel. But Israel was an occupying power. The UN defined it still as an occupying power because it controlled the borders, it controlled the water, it controlled the airspace. It laid siege to Gaza and all its people, and made them live in a totally unacceptable way, without enough food, without enough medicine, without enough ability to travel for emergency medical treatments. So there was no ceasefire. There was an occupation and a cruel containment in Gaza by the Israelis, hoping that this would create such difficult circumstances for the people in Gaza that they would rise up against Hamas. But this is a colonial delusion. Every colonial power has the same view, whether it was the French in Algeria, or the British in Kenya and India, or the Americans in Vietnam, the Americans in Afghanistan. They all say the same thing. And it's how the colonial mind works, because it only uses violence to control its foe, and its foe is somebody that it occupied. And it doesn't see the people that it's dealing with. In this case, the Israelis don't see the Palestinians, either in Gaza or the West Bank or anywhere. They don't see them as human beings with the same rights as the Israeli people have. And the traditional American mainstream media, which shapes the public thinking of the official parts of the government and public, the public at large. For years, the Israelis have successfully manipulated and influenced that media in a way that most people in the U.S. don't know anything about the Middle East. And what they know is they repeat what they hear from the media, which is very much shaped by Israeli ideology. And that's ideology says the Israelis are Democrats and peaceful people, and they just want to live in peace, doesn't say anything about how the Israelis took this land that was 93% Arab and turned it into a land that was 80% Jewish, with the direct help of the colonial powers in Britain, and then later with the United States. So there's no context, there's no clarity about why people do this. It's like saying, I remember what used to be called the race riots in the U.S. I'm old enough. I remember Newark and Los Angeles and Cleveland, back in the 60s and 70s. Every time the black Americans would erupt, people would say, things were so quiet, and what happened? Why did they suddenly wreck everything? Well, things were not quiet. These people were treated like animals by the official system and by society, by much of society, not all of it. So if you don't look at the context of a situation and why people do what they do, you're only going to get the view of one side.
Something else that I think has been very evident is the total double standard. I'm not saying anything original here, but it still is shocking. The framing of good and evil, of who is a terrorist and who is just defending themselves. And we see this so much in the way that Nasrallah is discussed and Hezbollah is discussed versus, let's say, Netanyahu and the IDF. What do you have to say to these claims that present Israel and the United States as, you know, beacons of democracy, while Iran, Lebanon, and Palestine, or I guess I should say the Iranian government, Hezbollah, and Hamas are terrorists?
This is a reflection of the success of Zionist and then Israeli state propaganda that has effectively conditioned the American public sphere since the 1950s, 40s, 50s, and has not been able to convince everybody in the U.S. now, because there are many people who don't believe this anymore. They see the reality of what Israel is doing. They see the suffering of the Palestinians, especially people who go there and visit. And the impact of Israeli propaganda, which includes outright lies, exaggerations, diversions, out-of-context statements, all kinds of things, has receded in its impact in American society. The main area where it is still very powerful is the Congress and the White House. And that's because the people there are electorally vulnerable. They can be thrown out of office. And they feel that by supporting Israel fully, they increase their chances of staying in office for various reasons. Some of them, you know, negative. For instance, people want at all costs to avoid being labeled as anti-Semites. And the anti-Semite accusation is now the leading instrument that Israel and its allies in the U.S. use to try to discredit or silence or traumatize people, but mainly to silence them. And it doesn't work like it used to. So while Congress and the White House remain the most collaborative with Israel in spreading these propagandistic narratives that are partly true, Israel is a democracy for its Jewish citizen, but not for its Arab citizens, and now it's getting less and less of a democracy. And the idea that it wants to live in peace, it withdrew from Gaza and got missiles in return, is a totally incomplete and exaggerated analysis of that situation. But the rest of American society is not falling for this propaganda as much as it used to. Young people especially, including young Jews, students in universities, church groups, African-Americans, Hispanic-Americans, a lot of progressive movements, labor unions, a lot of the groups are coming out and saying, look, there needs to be equity in this, how the U.S. deals with Israelis and Palestinians. The United States should treat them both as equals and try to mediate for a permanent peace solution, peace resolution, or peace agreement that gives them both the same rights simultaneously, an Israeli state, which exists but doesn't exist in a very happy state. Israel today is the most dangerous place in the world for a Jewish person to live. And that's not a very happy thing for Jews or for anybody. That nobody should be subjected to that kind of life. But the Israelis brought it upon themselves by so mistreating their neighbors, Lebanese, Palestinians, others, now Iranians, that their neighbors responded with the only thing that was available to them, which was violence. So because the Israelis refused to respond to overtures for political negotiations, Hamas, by the way, made at least 10 explicit overtures to the Israelis, to the American president, to George Bush, to the Rabin, the prime minister of Israel, to others in Israel. Most of these were discreet and private, but some were public. At least 10 times Hamas between the early 1990s and today has offered to negotiate and coexist with Israel in its 67 borders, with certain conditions being met on refugees and things like that. That would be based on international law, UN resolutions, and fair to both sides and agreed by both sides. The Israelis and Americans never responded. They didn't want to get into a negotiation with Hamas on these issues. So the idea that Israel is a peace-loving state that just wants to live with its neighbors quietly is not correct. It's not borne out by the behavior of the state of Israel in the face of Arab-Palestinian attempts. All the Arab countries and 57 Islamic states, Islamic majority states, offered in the Arab Peace Plan of 2003 or 2002 to offer to live with Israel peacefully, again, based on a withdrawal from the 67 occupied lands and negotiations that they would both agree on how to deal with the refugees. And, you know, when you mention refugees, the Israelis will automatically, you know, push the button. The Zionist Israeli propaganda comes out, says, oh, you want all the 6 million refugees to go back to Israel and destroy the state of Israel. That's not what the Arabs and the Muslim countries are saying. They're saying a negotiation on the refugee issue based on international law and UN resolutions that would be agreed by both sides, which means some refugees would go back, a number that would be reasonable and acceptable. Others would get compensation. Others would get restitution. But the whole point of what we've seen in the last few years, especially in the last year, since October 7th last year, is that the state of Israel is not interested in only, it's not only not interested in negotiating with Palestinians, it doesn't see the Palestinians as people who have any rights and sees them as animals that can be slaughtered and herded into areas and attacked from the air. So there's a lot of incidents that we see repeated all the time where in the Western world, whether it's government officials or media or others, they just repeat these slogans. For instance, the most common one, I heard it the other day when on the CBS interview with, what's his name, Coates, the fellow who wrote the book.
Ta-Nehisi Coates, yeah.
Yes, sorry. And the interviewer, I forget his name.
Tony DeCoupel.
That's him. Well, I'd never heard of him before.
Not much of a journalist.
Well, he said the most outrageous things, you know, and I heard this repeated several times in the last few days, where people would say something like, these Iranians and Arabs want to destroy the state of Israel. That's totally not true. I mean, 50 years ago, they might have said they wanted to destroy Israel and throw the Jews back to Europe or something like that. But that was in the heat of battle when the crime that Israel committed by taking Palestinian land and throwing the Palestinians out, or half of them, as refugees. But all of these people who are fighting Israel today have also reached the point where they've made the needed concessions that could spark a negotiation to reach a position, a state, where the Israeli state lives in recognized sovereignty and security, and the Palestinians get their recognized statehood and security and sovereignty, all negotiated to the satisfaction of both sides. Nobody's imposing anything, and nobody's trying to kill, destroy anybody else, except the Israelis are obviously now trying to destroy any vestige of life in Palestine and Gaza, and who knows what they'll do in the West Bank. And Lebanon and Iran our open questions as well. So we have this rampage of cruel, endless violence against civilians and some targets that are military targets, whether it's Hezbollah or Hamas, but most of the dying is being done by civilians in Lebanon and in Palestine. In Iran, we'll see what comes, if anything more there happens there. So we really are seeing some clarifications of what each side wants and what they are trying to achieve. The Israelis are clearly trying to achieve the full expulsion of the Palestinian population from Palestine, so that it can only be a land where the Jews, the Jewish people, rule. And this was stated in the statement of the present Israeli government, that only Jewish sovereignty reigns in the land they call it Judea and Samaria, we call it the land of historic Palestine. So this is a struggle that started 100 years ago with Balfour and the British and the UN League of Nations mandate, and it's continuing and it's getting more intense. And people of this region, whether they're Iranians or Arabs, Christians or Muslims, it doesn't matter what they are, they will not silently acquiesce in their own dehumanization and slaughter at the hands of settler colonial extremists who are directly aided and funded and armed by Western colonial powers. It just won't happen. It hasn't happened anywhere in the world. People fight back. Sometimes it takes them a while to figure out how to fight back. And what we're seeing now is this phase where the Arab states have not done anything seriously, and these non-state actors have emerged in their place. And if these non-state actors like Hamas and Hezbollah are battered to the point where they can't make any resistance moves against Israel militarily, I don't know what's going to happen next, but I do know that people are not going to roll over and play dead or surrender, because that's not because they're Palestinians or Arabs, because they're human beings. And the Israelis should know this, because they, being the state of the Jewish people, as they call themselves, they should know this better, because the Jewish people historically are one of the most dramatic examples of how subjugated people who are denied their rights resist and fight back. And sometimes it takes them a couple of thousand years to come back and fight. And this is what the Jewish people did after they fought in Masada and lost and were thrown out by the Romans. They came back and, you know, the late 19th century and 20th century, and when they were mistreated by the Russians and racist white Christian Europeans and North Americans, when they were asking to leave Eastern Europe and go live in Great Britain and the United States, and Great Britain and the United States passed laws to prohibit Jews coming into the country because they didn't want them, because these were anti-Semitic, white, racist, apartheid-loving imperial lands. And so the consequence is what we're seeing today. I'm shocked that the Jewish people, or the Jews of Israel, I can't speak of all Jews, but that the Jews of Israel, who in the government, would be acting with such cruelty and excessive military assault on mostly civilian populations. It's a real shock, but it'll have consequences.
Right. Going back to the idea of double standards, U.S. Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield at the UN, she said, "Iran's actions sought to cause significant death in Israel. It's time to condemn Iran for this unprovoked attack." I don't even know where to begin with that, but what's your response to the way she's describing this unprovoked attack?
So this is typical, that the Israelis and American officials and others in the West will say, well, the Iranians just attacked Israel with no reason. Israel was, you know, being peace-loving and was just protecting itself. But that's not correct. The Israelis have killed scientists and officials in Iran for years. They recently killed some in Lebanon. They killed some in Syria. And they assassinated the Hamas leader, Haniyeh, in Iran. And they've constantly threatened Iran with attacks against its nuclear facilities. Then they've pushed the Americans to sanction them, to attack them, to whatever. So it's not unprovoked. You can argue whether it was proportionally acceptable or was it excessive, or was you can argue about the nature of the attack, but it certainly was provoked by the way that Israel and the U.S., because it's become really they're a joint venture. They work together, and one of the things they work on is blaming Iran for all the bad things in the region, and all the threats against Israel originate in Iran, which is not very convincing. But a lot of the things the Israelis say are not convincing for people who are knowledgeable, but for people who are not knowledgeable of the region, what they're saying sounds, pretty reasonable. But the Israelis have to understand that the world, especially the Western world, especially the United States, is changing in terms of what people know about the Middle East, what they see on social media, what they see in alternative and progressive media. There's lots of truths and realities, and especially documented with films, that show what Israel is doing. And that's what people are starting to respond to by calling for a ceasefire in Gaza and calling for a suspension of American military aid to Israel, because the aid is being used to deny people their rights and in a way that's against American law. So these kinds of accusations by the American ambassador at the UN are not very serious. They're farcical, but they pass for normal standard operating procedures in an imperial power like the United States that totally agrees with what Israel is doing and is very happy to see the Palestinians mass slaughtered. The U.S., the only conclusion you can draw by looking at the Biden response and the British response and the Germans a little bit is that they're perfectly happy with this. You know, what Biden says that, they should reduce the civilian casualties or they should really make a ceasefire to exchange prisoners and hostages, that's totally insincere and totally contradicted by the actual policies of the United States in what it's doing. So you can't really put any credence in what any American official says about the Middle East. I mean, that's a pretty strong statement, but it's based on what we see happening.
Now, you've written this book, Understanding Hamas and Why That Matters. What are the things that we need to understand about Hamas? And also, what are the things that we need to understand about Hezbollah, especially given our incredibly biased media?
They're similar organizations.
Don't go anywhere yet, because we have another fascinating interview coming up right now. But to hear the rest of my interview with Rami Khoury and to see it, go to patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Also, if you haven't already, give us a like, give us a thumbs up. Now I speak to Arturo De Simone, an Aruban Argentine writer, artist, and active member of the social movement Llamamiento Argentino Judío. Arturo challenges the mainstream media narrative about how October 7th was the biggest pogrom against Jews since the Holocaust. We talk about the 2,000 Jews disappeared under the last military dictatorship that ruled Argentina from 1976 to 1983. So excited to be speaking to Arturo De Simone, who is based in Argentina. He is a writer, an artist, a political activist. He's a member of Llamamiento Argentino Judío. And he's going to be talking to us today about something that is not spoken about by Israel or by Israel defenders. A lot of people obviously have picked up this refrain of October 7th being the biggest massacre of Jews since the Holocaust. But Arturo has a different understanding of that. Do you want to just talk us through what your response to that claim is?
You know, like Noam Chomsky says, or had said, whenever you hear a very bold assertion being made with such confidence from leaders or from pundits, you should pause and ask yourself, is that true? Especially when it comes to something like the claim that the greatest pogrom ever waged after the Holocaust was on October 7th. And if you have ancestors who or relatives who were very much impacted by the Holocaust, who were in the Holocaust, as I do and as many others do, I think it's a very important question to raise.
Can you tell us about your relationship to the Holocaust, your family's relationship to the Holocaust?
Well, my grandfather narrowly eluded the Holocaust or the invasion of Poland, and most of his extended family ended up in Treblinka, among other places, the ghetto of Częstochowa. And so since I grew up in the Caribbean, where there's no real Holocaust education, I had to study this matter on my own. I read texts like, for example, Das Licht on the internet, which was about the tests that were conducted in concentration camps, memoirs that I could find, and, you know, not limited to the Spielberg accounts of history, not Steven Spielberg. And my father was from the dictatorship of the late 70s. He was not Jewish, but
He was from it? You mean like he wasn't part of it?
No. He was a musician who had to leave because of the circumstances that were menacing. And so I had to try to digest all this history on my own, more or less. And so I tried to talk to whichever relatives had knowledge about this and to understand. And it became very clear that there is a very strong continuum between the junta of the 1970s in Argentina, its propaganda, its methods of violence, and the Nazi regime. What's less well known was the fate of the Jewish community, and particularly Jewish dissidents in Argentina, in the what they call today the Global South. Argentina has the largest Jewish diaspora community. Roughly 20% or more of the young people who were forcibly targeted for disappearance, meaning they were detained and their remains were never found. Their deaths were unconfirmed, but it's almost certain that they were tortured to death. 20% of these disappeared were from the Jewish community. Of course, the prime motivation for this policy, the prime motivation was not because of their ethnicity, but rather because of their political activity, because of their opinions, because of their active in different political organizations of the left, of the center left, of the secular nationalist left. So for that reason alone, people in both center, mainstream, and the right of Argentinian politics have always insisted that their being Jewish had nothing to do with their persecution. And even the mainstream Jewish representative organization, the DAYA, which I guess is the equivalent maybe of something like ADL or B'nai B'rit or something in the United States, the DAYA, which is an official organ of representation, and also connects the local community to Israel, they fell into infamy because they tried to downplay the rumors of anti-Semitism, and they ignored when many mothers of young disappeared Jewish people came to their offices, to their attorneys, to plead for some form of help. And the answer that they got was that their children were either not assimilated enough or did not have sufficient Zionist education, and for that reason got into so much trouble. But the notion that their being Jewish had nothing to do with the way they were tortured, had nothing to do with the way they were abused, had nothing to do with the fact that Jewish martyrs of these events called the process, el proceso, Argentina, were disproportionately larger than they would. It was, you know, the number of the ratio of Jewish victims, or whatever you want to call it. Sometimes they don't like to be called victims because they were active politically, but the ratio of the dead and disappeared who were Jewish were just disproportionate, since it's a very tiny minority in Argentina, as it is in almost any other country other than Israel. And so this was disproven not by very nuanced investigations or not by some kind of deconstruction theory. This was disproven by the simple fact that there were many swastikas being worn. There were many pictures of Hitler, and Israeli officials and functionaries recount in books and in memoirs by figures like by Argentine journalists and scholars from the top, from back then and now, from Jacobo Timerman to Lautaro Bratzky, among other scholars, Hermann Schiller. They all recounted their containing the disgust at seeing a lot of Nazi paraphernalia. At Miriam Lewin, who was one of the key witnesses in the human rights trials of 1985, upon which the recent film, which I think is a very mediocre movie, but the recent movie, 1985, Argentina 1985, was based on largely on her testimony and the testimony of a few others. And Miriam Lewin was obviously Jewish. She testified how she was tortured in cells that had pictures of the Fuhrer, had pictures of Hitler. There was a great scandal that has been forgotten since then around the figure of Jacobo Timerman, the father of someone who became an important politician of the populist center left in Argentina. But Jacobo Timerman had been a Zionist, and he had been a deputy editor for a newspaper called La Opinión. La Opinión was part of the media corporation owned by a Jewish family of the press called David Greifer in Argentina. And so David Greifer's press organ was greatly envied by people who wanted to have a media monopoly in Argentina, and who today have a media monopoly, the Grupo Clarín, they're called. And they wanted to remove certain enemies from the market. And one of those enemies was David Greifer, who he was disappeared. His wife, who was non-Jewish, was told by her interrogators, how could you have married someone so impure? And his children were largely harassed or disappeared. His property and his wealth were confiscated. And Jacobo Timerman, during many, many interrogations, was faced with the abject anti-Semitism of his interrogators. For example, they would recite quotations from the protocols of the elders of Zion to him. And also, they were believers in a popular conspiracy theory at the time, which was invented by someone called Walter Beravaggi Allende. His name has nothing to do with Chile. Chile. Right.
And not the good Allende.
Yes. Walter Allende was a fanatical anti-Peronist nationalist and Semite who, I think, he came across and distorted a part of the history of the Zionist movement. As you may well know, the Zionist movement from the outset was not convinced that Palestine was the place to be, because Zionism at first, you know, wanted to see itself as a secularizing movement. Palestine was much too close to Europe, where all the historical enemies of the Jewish people were. So they were thinking about Argentina, which was an immense immigrant country with large regions that were good for agriculture, better for agriculture than Palestine. And so there was a time when there was a wave of Zionists who wanted to build little communes in the Patagonia, but afterwards that was not decided upon and they moved to Palestine. So the conspiracy theorists and a member of a Nazi circle or of a neo-Nazi circle, Walter Beravaci Allende, he was a school teacher who became a university professor thanks to dictatorships, and he promoted a conspiracy theory called Plan Andina, which claimed that the Jews want to take over all of Argentina, particularly the Patagonia, and they want to kill all the people who live there, and which is actually what people who the dictatorship defended actually did that, not the Jewish community at all. But this conspiracy called Plan Andina, which claims that the Jews want to take over Argentina for themselves and kill everyone living there, was very popular in circles of the police corps. And so Jacobo Timmerman, who was a very important journalist, was constantly being questioned about Plan Andina and how they intended to carry it out. And it's a very stereotypical anti-Semitic conspiracy theory. Maybe it sounds obscure to your viewers because it's so much about Patagonia, but it really is like any classical anti-Semitic idea you get from Russia or Ukraine or Germany. So that really disproved the idea that anti-Semitism did not form an important part of the way of thinking or of the world's view of the officials of the dictatorship. It was actually very much infused into their daily language, and there were special kinds of torture that were specifically reserved for Jews and to humiliate Jews. And Jewish young men who were drafted to fight the Falklands War also were systematically humiliated in the Falklands for being Jewish in ways that are, you know, quite disgusting. They were used for boxing practice, things that would actually remind, reading up the details about it in the book by Bradsky reminded me actually of some of the things that are being done to Palestinians right now. And one of the tortures in the dungeons of the dictatorship was to prop alive rats into the orifices of a man or a woman. In the case of a man, into the anus. In the case of a woman, into her sex organs. They were especially fond of doing this to Jews.
Right. Something that we know has been claimed to have happened on October 7th, although there's no evidence of this, but there is the refrain of the mass Hamas rape, right? Weaponized rape, mass rape. Ironically, the same people who talk about that, even though people who have come forward as witnesses have been debunked, the same people who talk about that totally ignore the fact that we do know is that Israel has surely raped Palestinians since October 7th. We know that because they gang raped a Palestinian prisoner on video. I mean, it was behind something, but they dragged him and did it. And that person was then taken to the hospital for internal injuries. And we know that there was rape because even Israeli police tried to detain Israeli soldiers accused of rape. And of course, that caused a protests and riots, basically, in which people were protesting for the right to rape. And we also know that there is an Israeli Knesset member who said in public, in front of people, that it was legitimate to insert sticks into people's rectums. And so what you're reminding me of now, and of course, I mean, for people who know about the disappeared and the torture that took place in places like Argentina and Chile, is that sexual torture was a systemic part of it. It wasn't like a one-off, like what you just talked about with rats. I mean, and also electricity and electrodes. I mean, it's absolutely disgusting. So yeah, that is rape that we know did happen.
Yes. The electrodes were, as a method, were imitated from the Franco-Algerians in the war in Algeria. Ironically, they used that also on, well, on people of all ethnicities, of course, but also on Jews. But
So it wasn't that these people were arrested, disappeared, killed for being Jewish per se. It's just that Jews were very overrepresented among leftists and dissidents, and that once they were in custody, I mean, that's once they were disappeared, once they were kidnapped, they would be singled out for particularly sadistic torture because of their Jewishness.
Yes. I mean, there's been a lot of debate about this, and at some point it was a taboo. It was a taboo because Peronism is a nationalist ideology, so we're supposed to believe, you know, and they claimed the memory of the 1970s, even though persecution began under Isabella Perón and the death squads that she created, the widow of Perón, began to persecute subversives. I mean, and so there's a lot of debate about this. There are many taboos about us. Some people say that every person were tortured according to their background. Everyone, the torturers always find your weaknesses or your something about you to use against. However,
so if you were gay, you would have been treated this way. If you were Jewish, you would have been
yes. Although what's irrefutable is that anti-Semitism was completely built into the worldview of the generals, each and every one of them, and they would make statements well into the 1990s that were very scandalously anti-Semitic. Some of them claimed that they lost the war in the Falklands because of the Jewish lobby. At some point, a general asked one of the officials of the mainstream Jewish organization to accompany him on a trip to Washington to convince the, you know, the so-called Jewish lobby to back them in the war against the British. So anti-Semitism was part of their explanation for why there was subversion, for why there was a revolutionary movement in Argentina. Part of their explanation, remember, they were people who had read a huge amount of Nazi literature. And so even though they were serving the interests of elites, were mostly concerned with how to allow the United States to implement the new economic model in their country and how to repress popular uprising, the generals themselves were steeped in neo-Nazi and Nazi literature and translations from, you know, this kind of Germanic literature. Their explanation of all this was that it was some Judeo-Bolshevik conspiracy. And of course, you could look at these other examples in history and say, well, you know, no one would deny the anti-Semitism of the Second World War, but to what extent was anti-Semitism what drove the Second World War? I think there were historians will not agree that it was simply anti-Semitism that drove the Second World War, but a coalescence of different morbid factors, including anti-Semitism, of course, but drove October 7th. I think it was an occupation that became exacerbated with the current cadre of fundamentalists in power in Israel.
Right. I mean, a lot of people, I mean, I think that there are a couple debates, right? So you brought up the, was it just anti-Semitism in the Holocaust that drove that? And you have a historiographical debate between people like Daniel Goldhagen, who wrote Hitler's Willing Executioners, and versus the much more nuanced and intelligent, I would say, analysis of someone like Norman Finkelstein. Yeah. What?
Raoul Hilberg,
Raoul Hilberg, right? Yes,
who's one of European Jews.
I mean, and to me, it's a no-brainer, honestly, that it was not just pure anti-Semitism per se. I mean, what triggered it, right? Obviously, the depression, the Treaty of Versailles, humiliation. None of this is to justify it. I mean, I obviously, as someone who had family killed in the Holocaust, I'm not making an excuse, but there's also a debate. And to me, again, it's a no-brainer. I mean, Hamas makes it clear that their opposition, what they're opposing is not Jewishness or Jews. It's Zionism, a political project, and it's the occupation. Whereas during the Holocaust, I mean, what got you killed was not anything to do with politics, although they, of course, did. The Nazis killed communists, but when they killed Jews, they would kill Jews for being Jews. Of course, there were Jews who were communists, like who were killed for being communists before they were killed for being Jews. But my point is, it's very different. The anti-Semitism that was, you know, on display during the Holocaust, they didn't care about your politics if you were Jewish.
Well, what the junta and the Third Reich, one of the many things they had in common in their form of propaganda was to blame every national economic crisis on Jews. The difference, a major difference, was the timeline, though. So Hitler came to power, he built a welfare state that privileged the German Christian Aryan middle class and excluded everyone else, reduced everyone else to slavery. And so then, supposedly, the economic crisis was resolved. He blamed the preceding economic crisis on Jews rather than on the failure of the system itself. And the Argentine dictatorship, they would blame their failures in the moment. So they, you know, perhaps a little, tiny little bit like Milei, though I don't see Milei as a fascist or an extremist, but they would, what their politics, they promised that their economic policies would save the country, would fix the country's economic crisis. When their economic policies did the opposite, when they backfired, when they caused more crises, more poverty and misery, what did they do? All of their official organs, their newspapers, and the television, which they controlled, there was a lot of anti-Semitic content on television, would blame different Jewish conspirators or different Jewish financial elites. And of course, there was an interest also of old money, Argentine old money. So old families came from the colonial period, who had their roots with the Franco and Franco-Spanish early colonists. Argentine old money was very interested in getting rid of its competition, new money. And so the newest part of the bourgeoisie more often included these ethnic minorities like Jews and Armenians and so on. So these things are rather similar to anti-Semitism elsewhere. While Hitler, in artificial means of slave labor, resolves unemployment and economic crisis in Germany, the Argentine junta, they failed to do so, but they blamed their failures on Jewish conspiracies all the time. And there was also another factor was that the attacks on Jewish communities, like the famous Jewish neighborhood of Buenos Aires, Barrio Once, they call it Neighborhood 11, which is next to Villa Crespo, which is also a very Jewish neighborhood. Today it has all kinds of immigrants from all over the world, but you often see Orthodox Jews and rabbis walking around. There were many, many attacks by gangs, by neo-Nazi groups like Tacuara, which is an infamous neo-Nazi group in Argentina. There were many, many attacks on Jewish schools, on Jewish stores, attacks of vandalism, and these were not perpetrated directly by the government. However, the gangs and criminals would carry out these attacks during the 1970s. They knew that they could expect impunity. They knew that nobody would prosecute them, and they were completely free to get away with vandalism, with also firebombs, and so on in Jewish neighborhoods. So they did tyrannize the Jewish neighborhoods because they knew they could do so without any consequences from the authorities. Whereas in the past, when such a thing would happen, and it happened a lot in Argentina, there were anti-Semitic gangs in Argentina that were very cruel in the way they abused the Jewish community. However, when they went to such an extreme, it would become a scandal in the press, in the newspapers. Whereas during the regime, there was a general atmosphere of claiming, as the dictatorship, as one of its slogans went, life is normal here. And so there was an effort to always downplay the problem of anti-Semitism in Argentina. And so when rabbis such as Marshall Meyer and a less well-known but earlier and very important rabbi whose name escapes me at the moment, they would try to alert conferences or congresses like the American, I don't know if it's called the American Jewish Congress, or these kind of events in the United States, and institutions like the Anti-Defamation League. Argentine rabbis would try to alert the press, and the Jewish press in the United States. The Jewish press, I mean Jewish newspapers, like the Forward, as well as the ADL. But when they would do so, official representatives or talking heads of mainstream Jewish community called the Daya, which is an organization that has kind of like a monopoly in Buenos Aires, the Daya would then deny these claims, would try to discourage people from believing them, or would create a counter argument. And that's because they were very much integrated into the dictatorship, and they were in denial, and they refused to help the mothers and relatives of disappeared members of the community, and they would humiliate them routinely, and they would ignore them or blame them for having raised children who were ideologically corrupted or who became quote-unquote terrorists.
And can you talk about Israel's response to this anti-Semitism?
Of course. So Israeli officials were aware of this, and the level of awareness was still a matter of debate until very recent research by an Israeli Uruguayan scholar named Gerardo Liebner, who he would be on your show if he spoke any English, I'm sure. But so when relatives of disappeared young Jewish people saw that they would not get any attention from official mainstream community leadership, they resorted to the Israeli embassy. And back then, every group in Argentina resorted to its club, you know, whether it was Italians or Italian descendants or whoever. So they resorted to the Israeli embassy. And many times, the response is very similar. For example, the ambassador, Ram Curiel, said to one of the Jewish women who became one of the May Plaza mothers, Madam, you keep talking about disappeared people, and we at the embassy are not interested in that topic. We don't want to hear about it. There was a later ambassador, Ram Nirgad, who, under a lot of pressure, began to make exceptions. And so every so often, he would help with getting a person to escape. So, for example, your friend Mark, who's part of the activists, seen
Edkin, right.
Yes, his father escapes together with a man from the ghetto of Prague with a man who then immigrated to Argentina. And so that man's son, José Rosenblatt, I think is the name, or Rosenberg, José Rotenberg, was systematically disappeared. And his sister was able to escape and went to Israel as a refugee. But these people, they were in a minority. That was nevertheless important. But overall, there was a culture of denial from the Israeli embassy. High-ranking Israeli generals visited Argentina. Yitzhak Rabin visited Argentina to give a speech. And when someone tried to interrupt his speech, his lecture to a military audience to alert him to the plight of Jewish victims, he was immediately escorted out, violently so, and the event was drawn to a close. That was at the Sheraton Hotel. And this man was later confronted for having spoken out, called a provocateur. Other Israeli generals visited Argentina because there was a major interest in selling weapons to the country. And so, and Ram Nirgad, the ambassador, was aware of this. and try to calculate whether this, in to what extent this was a good or a bad idea to sell weapons to both Argentina and the Chilean regime when these two regimes were at war. However, the plight of disappeared persons being tortured was very widely, it was already well known by them. And so there's a famous saying by a May Plaza mother who is Jewish, Renee Eppelbaum, who said, whose three of her children were systematically detained and disappeared. I remember when I say disappeared, it means they were probably, they were in all likelihood tortured to death and the remains were eliminated. So three of her children suffered this fate. And she said, it torments me to think that my Jewish children were killed by Israeli weapons, because there was a large-scale flow of weapons to Argentina. It was almost, it's almost a pattern that's well known by now, that whenever a regime like the South African regime gets a weapons embargo in the UN, in which the United States is participating, and Jimmy Carter wanted the weapons embargo against Argentina, then Israel starts to amp up and to increase the flow of weapons to that regime. That was the case in South Africa, where, of course, a minority of the victims were Jewish, because it, you know, South African racism was, of course, about very poor black majority. But Ruth First, who is Jewish, who helped write the South African Constitution, was killed by a litter bomb. And that's not irrelevant to this topic. And so the planes that were used for the death flights, some of them were of Israeli manufacture. Hermann Schiller, who's a famous Argentine Jewish journalist, who started a human rights organization in Argentina during the dictatorship, responds to the lack of activity from the embassy and the mainstream Jewish leadership. He recalls how in a debate with a former Israeli functionary or ambassador in Israel, the Israeli ambassador retorts, defending the Israeli arms trade with the dictatorship by saying, oh, Israel only sold 13% of the regime's armamentistic needs, right? And so for Schiller, that being a defense or a legitimation says it all, right? So the weapons trade was unscrupulous, and there were false claims and exaggerations, claims that this had nothing to do with anything except Menachem Begin wanting to get back at the British during the Falklands War, because Menachem Begin, former Israeli prime minister, was very anti-British, and he had blown up the King David Hotel to get the British to hasten the end of the British mandate in Palestine so that the state of Israel could be declared. And so it was just Menachem Begin's anti-Britishness. But this is simply not true, because the Israeli complicity and the arms trade relations predate the Falklands War, the Malvinas War. It's from before then. And it's very ironic also that despite that they were selling weapons to the Falklands, to Galtieri's, for Galtieri's war efforts over the islands, that Jewish soldiers were demoted according to their ethnicity, no matter how capable they were as fighters. They were told things like, you know, sergeants would tell them, your rifle and uniform would be clean if you were fighting for Israel and not for Argentina. They told them that they can't possibly have real loyalty to Argentina since they're Jews. And they were forced to just clean latrines all the time and subject to other humiliations, used for target practice, for boxing practice. So, meanwhile, Israel was happy to do business with this army. So, and Israel was happy to do business with, again, the regime that was saying all these atrocious things and participating. It can only be described as a bureaucracy that, among other things, was deeply anti-Semitic, just as a Nazi bureaucracy you could, you know, a standard, very dry Marxist would say that the Nazi bureaucracy's main purpose was to destroy the Soviet Union and to stop communism. And, well, there's a, I think it's a little bit more nuanced than that. However, there's no doubt that the Nazi bureaucracy was that and was fucking anti-Semitic. And I think the same thing can be said of the junta. Their priorities might have been about economics and about destroying populism, but they were also blatantly and undeniably fucking anti-Semitic and strangely in bed with the Israeli embassy. And if you count the amount of people, there are discussions whether there are 1,800 Jews tortured to death and disappeared, or 2,000, whether it was 20% of the disappeared, a little bit less, a little bit more, then add the people who died in random violence against Jews because neo-Nazis knew that they could act with impunity. Either way, it's more than the civilian casualties of the ongoing war that started on October 7th for Jews, not for Palestinians, of course.
Right. Well, very well said. Thank you so much for talking to us. This has been really informative, and I think it's an important point. So really appreciate your talking to me about this. And lastly, tell us what Llamamiento Argentino Judío is.
Right. So Llamamiento Argentino Judío is an important political organization in Argentina. It is a secular organization for Jewish progressives. The organization has been around since the Macri years. That started also when the abuse of Jewish pasts to serve these very alien purposes of the right wing in Argentina began around the time of the last administration of Cristina Kirchner, when there were claims that the death or the suicide of the lawyer Nisman was a conspiracy to cover up Argentine complicity with Iran in the bombing of the Amia Center. And there are many reasons, there are many other important, more valid theories as to what could have happened around the Amia, including local anti-Semitic authorities who believed in Plan Andinia and who had faced impunity during the dictatorship. Also, there's the possibility of Syrian involvement. But the point is that Llamamiento Argentino Judío started around then to stop the way the Jewish voice is constantly being appropriated and monopolized for the interests of the right in Argentina, particularly the anti-populist right. And, of course, they're very active on Israel-Palestine issues and on issues to fight poverty. And this summer, I organized kind of a congress or panel of Argentinian human rights lawyers and Chilean Palestinian human rights lawyers who came together in a cedar in Argentina to talk about universal jurisdiction. So how to use the universal jurisdiction laws in Argentina to possibly take Israeli war criminals to court, because Argentina has a long judicial tradition of that. Argentine lawyers took elements of the Franco regime to court. They took elements of the Turkish functionaries responsible for the Armenian genocide to court. And I had an Armenian young lawyer who's from that tradition, that legal tradition, speak about his experiences taking Turkey to court over the Armenian genocide to see what we could learn from that. I also different experts in law spoke about the possibilities or lack thereof when it comes to using universal jurisdiction against war criminals anywhere and now, including Israel. There's also a case in Argentina against, for example, Russia. I have nothing to do with that, but I wanted to start this discussion about universal jurisdiction in Latin American countries, because I believe that the only way to make the rulings or almost quasi-rulings of the International Court of Justice, ICC, at all meaningful, is through civic action citizen groups have to activate the legal system so that these do not become a mountain of meaningless paper victories for the Palestinians while they just continue to die the way they currently are dying.
Well, and thank you so much for introducing me to Luis Cohn, who is another member of that organization. And I interviewed him because for the documentary that I'm working on about Holocaust survivors speaking out against the genocide in Gaza, his father's entire family was killed during the Holocaust. And he's someone who really speaks out against it. As a human rights lawyer, can explain why it is a genocide and also why it's such a betrayal of a certain Jewish tradition from which he and his family come.
I'm happy to introduce you to them, to him and to others.
Yes. Great. Thank you so much. Okay. Have a great day, Arturo, and we will see you again sometime.
Thank you, Kate.
Bye. Thank you so much for watching The Katie Halper Show. Make sure you join our Patreon at patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Where you can see the full interview with Rami Khoury. Make sure you give us a like, make sure you subscribe, and we will see you next week. Bye, everyone.